The Guardian.
We're back, and we're in Edinburgh, where the biggest and brightest brains in British TV are spending their bank holiday weekend at the Media Guardian Edinburgh International Television Festival. I'm Matt Wells, and you'd expect me to start with the pithiest clip from the most important session of the weekend, and this podcast will be no different.
I'm gay, you dirty bitch. Fuck off.
That's quite enough gawk for one podcast. This year's festival slogan is We Love TV, and this man wants to spread the word.
Regulators and politicians can make all the highfalutin demands they like, but if people don't turn on to watch, we're all just whistling in the wind.
Hero of the hour, we talk to the king of cult TV, Tim Kring.
Whenever you antagonize the audience by taking product away from them, they will find their entertainment someplace else, and whether they come back to you will be on their terms.
Hideously white, why are there no black or Asian faces at the top table?
I think this whole thing that we're seeing with Julian Bellamy, Danny Cohen, Jay Hunt, Dawn Airey, this magic circle of people who move from jobs to jobs, when did the pool get that small? For white people, never mind black people.
This is an Edinburgh Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, we've gone to absolutely no expense to find what looks like a picnic table at which to seat my guests for this week's show. Hello and welcome back to Emily Bell, Director of Digital Content at The Guardian. How are you, Emily? Are you getting enough sleep?
I'm well.
Yes.
And I am getting enough sleep, depending on how to find enough.
Right, well, enough to keep going for the next half an hour.
Yes, exactly.
The power behind this festival is the executive chair, am I right?
I think that's what they call me, isn't it?
Tim Hinks is, in his spare time, he's the boss of Endemol UK. How's it been for you so far?
It's been a great festival, I think, and I think, to answer your other question, sleep is a luxury, I think, at Edinburgh. Unlike this picnic table, as you say. I think picnic table is even going a little bit far.
It's a picnic table, but it is in a nightclub.
It seems to be in a disused nightclub in the bowels of the conference centre, so thanks for that.
We are in the bowels of the Edinburgh International Conference Centre, where this festival is taking place. And when Tim invited Peter Fincham to deliver the keynote festival address, he'd just been fired as controller of BBC One, taking responsibility for the faking of a promo clip involving the Queen. Annoyingly, he later took up the job of director of television at ITV, which must have had Mr. Hinks cursing him. Nevertheless, he persevered, and Fincham's brief was to re-energise an embattled industry, and he started by knocking an easy target, Ofcom's Public Service Broadcasting Report.
What you'll find in this report, and it's echoed in Channel 4's lengthy doorstopper, Next on 4, is a version of television that's understood by regulators, consultants, strategists and media commentators. Unfortunately, if the person in the street or indeed on the sofa were to overhear us talking this language, they'd wonder what on earth we were talking about. Here we have the deathless language of the committee, each word carefully weighed, balanced and rinsed of all life and passion. A definition of PSB that surely exists only in the minds of those whose job it is to write such definitions.
He went on to hit out at a public survey carried out by Ofcom, saying it was skewed to show that audiences didn't want entertainment.
So there we have it. Let's scrap Saturday nights completely. Drama's out, comedy too. No role for sport, the Champions League, Euro 2008, the Olympics. The 14 million people who tuned into the finals of Britain's Got Talent weren't there to be entertained, but to watch TV promote understanding of religions, cultures and lifestyle. Don't get me wrong. Television needs regulators just as roads need traffic wardens. But you wouldn't ask your traffic... you wouldn't ask your traffic warden to give you advice on what sort of car to buy, still less how to drive it.
And he didn't just have a go at the commercial regulator. Peter Fincham described being hauled before the BBC Trust, which wanted to know why the corporation gave away cash in game shows.
What's the justification, I was asked. Because it increases the drama. Because it makes the programmes more exciting. Because the viewers like it. Because the days of fobbing winners off with a three-piece suite or a cuddly toy have gone. Because why was I even having to justify it? At one point I was asked, what is distinctive about the way we give away cash prizes? I don't know, in brown envelopes. Swiss bank accounts, shares in Northern Rock.
And he concluded with a barnstorming rallying call for popular television.
Between now and 2012, we have a choice. We could let fragmentation wash the old order away and seek comfort in television that ticks the right boxes. Or we can fight to say that broad is the key part of broadcasting, that television will serve society better if it unites audiences than if it scatters them, that regulators and politicians can make all the highfalutin demands they like, but if people don't turn on to watch, we're all just whistling in the wind, and that those who want to reach big audiences with high-quality popular television should be encouraged in that mission.
Now, we'll come to our panel in a moment, but first let's hear what the audience at the McEwen Hall thought.
Melvin Bragg, Lord Bragg, distinguished programme maker, you must have cheered to the rafters, that speech.
Every programme maker loved the way he attacked regulators, although they can be okay.
Easy target, though.
Well, even so, it was bold of him to do it, given that ITV needs regulators to be on their side at the moment.
Oh, my goodness me, Matt Wells.
A regulator.
Radio Guardian.
Radio Guardian. This is David Lindemann. You're a regulator. He didn't like you lot very much.
Oh, he didn't like being asked about prize money on BBC game shows, but I thought it was great. I think he's slightly tilting at windmills. I don't see any great evidence that Ofcom are trying to turn ITV into Radio 4.
John Whittingdale, chairman of the House Commons Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee. I don't entirely agree with him. There is a problem. ITV actually exemplifies the problem. ITV has stopped doing current affairs. ITV has stopped doing children's production. ITV is desperately trying to get out of its current regional commitments, and those things are important. And public service broadcasting does require that there be other broadcasters besides the BBC doing them. And I think that he rather failed to meet that argument.
Don't you take the point, though, perhaps that that regulators don't understand what television is about, which is entertaining, and that's what people want?
Ofcom aren't talking about television. They're talking about a specific part of television, which is public service broadcasting.
Andy Duncan, Chief Executive, Channel 4.
You must be very glad, Andy, that Channel 4 wasn't at the sharp end of a McTaggart lecturer's tongue this year.
Well, we've had a few of those over the years, but we can cope with it. Given what happened last year, you know, good for the audience that was here.
This is Jana Bennett, Director of Television for the BBC. What's your view?
I think he said a lot of really, really great sort of true things about the nature of television as a mass medium.
Might you argue that it was a bit thin on substance?
I think he wasn't attempting to put on a menu of prescriptions, and I think a clear McTaggart like that, rather than trying to vie with policy, you know, the policymakers, actually was part of the point of the speech.
Mostly a positive reaction there, but Emily Bell, it was a crowd pleaser, wasn't it? And, you know, undoubtedly the best received McTaggart for years.
Yeah, though, I have a feeling we always say that year after year. So like Jeremy Paxman last year was a crowd pleaser and the best received. It really was. There was a gust of warm appreciation from everybody. I don't think, as somebody said to me, these are not my words, but he said it doesn't really bear any analysis at either a high or a low level, that actually all the stuff about the regulator using dry language, etc., that's what I want from my regulators. I don't want a slightly over-emotional, very inconsistent, passionate regulator. That's not what it's there for. So I slightly thought, easy targets. Yes. But it was well written, and it was, by
very
all
well
accounts,
delivered.
Brilliantly delivered. I don't think that there is much there other than a highlighted general dissatisfaction with Ofcom, which is actually, frankly, a little bit like playing Bohemian Rhapsody at the Encore. You know, everybody's going to like it.
Tim, did he do the business for you?
I think it was a great McTaggart, and I think that you're right. Yes, it played extremely well in the hall, and, you know, I don't think we should be ashamed of that, or certainly the festival shouldn't, because it's the industry gathering together, it's made by them, it's for them, and so I think it worked on that level absolutely 100%, and I suspect, we probably do always say it's been a great year, but I think last year was good. No, I know you don't. No, you don't say it's a great anything.
It's actually been quite nice about it this year, haven't we? So
well, you're very conflicted, aren't you? You'd like to bash it, but it's got your name on the top, so what are you going to do? But I think that it was warmly received. Maybe for journalists, there's a bit less that you can sort of riff off the back of it than some of the others, but I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing for us as a festival, because I think we necessarily needed to look at ourselves and look where we were after a sort of pretty grim year. And also, I think when you are talking about sort of big ideas like entertainment and show business, it can often be categorised as being a bit sort of less than interesting. interesting, and actually it's the very heart of what we do, and that was kind of his point.
No, I think that's right. The problem in some ways was there was a bit of a lack of prescription after that, and he very much teed up the weekend to encourage other ITV executives to say, set us free so we can make great programmes. This is one thing we all agree, everyone, even probably Tim Garton, loves programmes, and so does Edra, and so does Ed Richards. But the idea that in some way the big entertainment blockbusters are in any way under threat is actually bogus. They're just not. That those are not the. There's really not the areas of programming.
So he was setting up an Aunt Sally.
He was somewhere between Bohemian Rhapsody and Aunt Sally, yes, is what you're saying. What I think he was saying was, fine, yes, maybe the X Factor's not under immediate threat, but that area of programming, big shows, dramas, entertainment shows, it's not getting any easier. It's clearly under threat, and if we sort of spend our time taking them for granted, we're going to end up regretting it.
I think where he was absolutely right is to say, look, let's just try and widen this to a wide road. Was it a wide road where high and low can intertwine. I do think that actually saying, look, when we are talking about television and quality, let's talk about a totality. Let's not just focus on what the market doesn't provide or what will get a good write-up in The Guardian or, you know, all the things that sort of push the buttons, the backbenchers. That's absolutely legitimate, and I think he did a very good job in getting that across.
One of the, possibly, I may be imagining this, but it seems to be one of the byproducts of it already, what you could see in the PSB session today, where Andy Duncan was obviously making the familiar, but I mean very articulate, but familiar Channel 4 argument. And he sort of won, I think, the day in terms of something must be done. But when you now analyse it and the sort of key charge of are they going to be BBC Five, you know, what happens? OK, so you get some public money, whatever it is, and then you've got committees of people sort of, in a sense, deciding what you should and shouldn't do in the extreme. Perhaps the argument's becoming an argument about creativity on the back of what Peter's got. It's about the programmes.
Yes, it is and it isn't about the programmes, because actually what it's about now is about sustaining existing organisations on the grounds that they are the best people to make programmes. Now, when you see Peter Fincham in the big room, you want to give him money to make programmes because he's credible, articulate, charming, all of that. When you see Kevin Ligo, you want to get Channel 4, you want to give him money to make programmes. Jay Hunt, you want to give it because these people are credible because they're lively, they're engaged, they're passionate, etc. But actually, you know, this is about an institutional preservation, and there's no reason, given the structural changes in broadcasting, actually, why the next generation of Kevin Ligos, Peter Finchams, Jay Hunts can't work in different types of organisations and not within Channel 4 or ITV. And I think that's where the whole argument comes completely unstuck. Three thumbs up, if I were a mutant, to Peter Fincham.
Three cheers,
yes, that's right, it is. Yes, it's a rallying cry to great creative programmes, but you need then the examination of the existing broadcasters, one of them not even run by anyone who makes programmes. Why are they the best institutions to carry on doing this? And you get on at the same time people going, because the world is profoundly changing, so it's actually a really good idea to have the people who've been doing it all along carry on doing it. And I sort of think, yes, okay, but there's something about this which just does not hang together.
Tim, how annoyed were you when Peter Fincham took up that job at ITV?
I wasn't annoyed at all.
But you were hoping he would spill the beans on Crangate, and now he's chastened by the corporate culture at ITV.
No. When I spoke to Peter right from the beginning, we were very clear. You know, he wasn't going to start talking about the Queen and what happened and what didn't happen. I think the truth is, though, when I talked to him, I thought we needed, let's say, an insider to sort of make the creative case in some way or another. He was the first choice for that. And yes, there are a few more references to ITV than I imagined when I talked to him back in November. But the fact is, I think he delivered pretty much the speech he would have delivered anyway.
Are you disappointed, Emily, that he swept away Crowngate with a joke?
Well, what's he going to say? From a journalistic point of view, of course, one is always disappointed he didn't get up and say, I can't believe I had to carry the can for that. It should have been, you know, you're looking for a juicy story. But actually, you know, haven't we all sort of slightly, I don't know, I sort of slightly feel that we've moved on a little bit from that. You know, that's not just navel gazing, that's getting out the tweezers and scraping out the scummy fluff.
I think we better leave that right there. You can find much more about Peter Fincham's MacTaggart on mediaguardian.co.uk.
Do you ever get the feeling like you were meant to do something extraordinary?
Yes, we are all special. Some individuals, it is true, are more special. It begins as a single individual.
One.
Seemingly ordinary, except they're not.
You are indeed very special. And you need to be strong for what's to come.
No one with superpowers around this table, I'm afraid, but Heroes has been one of the hit US imports of the last year or two, and the festival invited the creator, Tim Kring, to talk about the show, and it was one of the best-received sessions, actually. I talked to Kring after the event, and I asked him where the idea had come from.
I was supposed to come up with another television show as part of my deal at the network, and I started thinking about what it was that I wanted to do. I was fascinated by this whole idea of open-ended, serialized storytelling. Shows like Lost and 24 had sort of re-energized this idea of a serialized show. And so I looked at my own network that did not have one of these, and I had sort of some lofty goals, and they came out of raising two small kids and thinking about the world that they were going to inherit. And I started to think about, wouldn't it be great to do a show that spoke to some of those fears and created a sense of sort of hope.
Did the choice of subject matter then affect how you then started about seeding it in the audience? Because you did it rather unconventionally by, instead of showing the pilot on the network, you showed it to a convention of games fans.
Right, exactly. It was sort of both a bold move and a kind of, we had nothing to lose. Somehow, they had put together a 2,000-seat venue of these rabid fans who came into it wanting to love it.
And this is interesting, because it could have gone the other way. They could have hated it.
Absolutely. And
you'd been killed before it was launched.
In retrospect, it was a very dangerous move. It was a chance to go to what, you know, I guess is the early adopters, people who will go out there and they will create buzz and create websites. And it is publicity and marketing that you cannot buy.
It does mean, though, now that you have a very close relationship with your audience, and they tell you what they like and they tell you, yes, what they hate, and they didn't like the second season. You took an interesting decision to address the criticism, and you decided to face it straight on, and you in effect admitted that some of the criticism was right. Is that right?
Yes, I did. I mean, the truth is, I was asked the question. I was not asked whether I was sorry for anything. I was asked a very frank question that nobody had ever asked me. Is there anything you would do differently? And the truth is, on any given day, there's about 10,000 things that I would do differently. You know, you'll go down to the set and you'll go, my God, how did that wall get painted green? Or why is she wearing a hat? So when asked if there was something that I would have done differently, I said, yes, there's this and this and this. I also had the luxury of knowing where we were going. I had seen the last 5 episodes of this volume, and they were among the best episodes that we'd ever made. So I felt fairly kind of confident that I could come out and say something like that and then very immediately deliver.
You were hit quite badly by the writer's strike, weren't you, which came in the middle of your second season.
We had a very fortunate thing in that we were just wrapping up episode 11, which was the end of our second volume. So we had a beginning and a middle and an end to our season that most people didn't have. We ended up jettisoning the second volume completely.
And we should explain, perhaps, for people who don't know the series, the volumes are groups of episodes,
yes,
within the season, right?
Yes, I decided that it was really important for a show like this to try and tell its stories in volumes rather than seasons, so that you could invite new audience to join. One of the problems with a serialized show is that once you start dragging too much story behind you, they can become really impenetrable for new audience to find.
And do you think that's what happened to other shows, like Lost, for example?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. And I know just personally, there have been shows that I've tried to watch in its third season for the first time and felt very sort of rejected by the show.
And how bad was the writer's strike more broadly for the television industry? What's your view of it?
Well, clearly, we'll find out in the next few weeks when the fall season launches. But whenever you antagonize the audience by taking product away from them, they will find their entertainment someplace else. And whether they come back to you will be on their terms.
Tim Kring, and Heroes is back on BBC Two in September. It's a busy old place, the Edinburgh International Conference Centre. I'm out and about now, standing outside some of the main conference halls, people being ushered into sessions, rushing out of others, and trying not to be late for appointments.
There'll be lots of things going on over this weekend, lots of other things being discussed. Among them, the state of television drama. And the conclusion of the room seemed to be that the problem with television drama, and the problem with people who commission television drama in particular, is that they don't take enough risks.
Let's bring the lights up and open it up to the audience.
Matt Wells from The Guardian. When you see the final cut of something that is really, really terrible, do you sit there and think, oh my God, this is a stinker, what we're going to do? Because the audience knows, we know, when I watched the first episode of Echo Beach, you know, I knew immediately that this is terrible. Do you think that the commissioner, the person who commissioned it, felt the same way when they viewed it?
Aren't you sitting next to her?
How did you feel when you saw it?
Well, I think...
Sorry, Laura.
Well, I think that while you're on Echo Beach, I'd just like to point out that...
It was awful, wasn't it?
No, because moving wallpaper in Echo Beach, I would say, was one of the biggest risks I took as a commissioner. Now, I wouldn't say Echo Beach was terrible because it wasn't made in isolation. It was made as part of what Tony Jordan wanted to write about, which was a double-headed drama which hadn't been done before.
There's always a point at the TV festival where organisers ask someone from outside the television industry to come and give everyone a collective kick up the backside, and the Future View Address, as it's called, which is designed to look into the crystal ball and see what's going to happen to television in the next few years. That task fell to the internet guru Clay Shirky, who came over from New York to put the collective frighteners up everyone.
It's so cheap to distribute things globally that the question, why produce this, why publish this, why put this out there, that question has gone from why do it to why not do it, right? If I've got a photo that's going to amuse even three of my friends, why not put it online? What's the downside? So the average quality of what gets produced is now very low. But the average quality of what gets consumed is much higher. Because we're now in a world of publish, then filter. All the filters are after the fact. The way quality is enforced on a digital network is not by not producing bad stuff, but instead by ignoring it.
There's always the compulsory policy session at the TV festival. Public service broadcasting is always up for discussion in one form or another. It was a rather animated debate this year, particularly from the ITV grandee, Lord Melvin Bragg.
Over the past 20 or 30 years, as everybody here knows, a lot of apparently unassailable great British industries have crashed through lazy, careless, or arrogant refusal to adapt to change. I think the same could happen to ITV. If that did happen, the knock-on effect would be damaging and diminishing both the entire TV industry and the creative economy as a whole. And it will be our fault that on our watch, at this time, we didn't grasp and force through hard decisions to change and ensure an unleashed, non-nanny state ITV.
You can't have a festival without an awards ceremony. This festival is no different. At Edinburgh, it's the Channel of the Year Awards. And presenting the awards this year was the comedian Michael McIntyre.
Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of the 2008 Channel of the Year is BBC One!
That's an astonishing achievement by me in 3 months, don't you think? I mean, that's good, isn't it? Obviously, this is not for me. This is for Controllers Past. It's for Peter, someone I admire hugely. He's done a fantastic job with BBC One. For Rowley, who sat there for months and months and months waiting for me to turn up and did a fantastic job. For Jaina, who's presided over it all and has been a remarkable boss.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
Now, in the last couple of decades, there have been huge strides made in the cause of gender equality in television, to the point that many of the most senior executives in British TV are women. But the same cannot be said for ethnic minority representation, where the picture, frankly, is woeful. The comedian Lenny Henry called this year for affirmative action, and Jonathan Ross said the only black people employed at the BBC were in menial jobs. Diversity of the gender and ethnic varieties were the subject of two sessions in Edinburgh, and I caught up with two of the participants.
Daisy Goodwin, and I run Silver River Productions.
Pat Young, the president and general manager of the Travel Channel in the USA.
What do you perceive as being the problem in British television when it comes to ethnic diversity?
Increasingly for the senior jobs, they seem to be fishing in a smaller and smaller pool. So Julian Bellamy goes to the BBC, Danny Kerr replaces him, and then when Julian goes from the BBC to Channel 4, Danny goes from Channel 4 to the BBC. When did the pool get that small? For white people, never mind black people. And if white people can't get big jobs, there's no chance that black people will. The second problem that you face is just, you know, we're not bringing through. In order to get one controller, you need 30 or 40 potential candidates. The BBC have 5% of their ethnic minority, managers are ethnic minorities. That's 35 people across the corporation. And there are none in sport, there are none in marketing, there are very few in vision and in news and in audio. And if those big production departments aren't producing the managers, then the BBC's never going to change. But, you know, it's one of those things, if you don't keep making pressure, you won't get change.
What do you think needs to be done?
If there are targets and people don't meet them, sack them. You know, it's called accountability. There's a lack of it. The BBC's got a public target, they miss it, and nothing happened. Well, they didn't get their bonus 2 years ago. Well, they've still missed it, yeah, and they got their bonus this year. You know, if I miss my targets, I get sacked.
In terms of gender diversity, it's a good news story in Britain, isn't it? All these women running TV channels all over the place. You've got a very successful independent production company.
Yeah, I think for women, it's a pretty good place to be, actually. I mean, compared to most other professions in this country, I think telly's quite female-friendly. Probably not quite so many at board level, but I'm not sure whether that's to do with discrimination or simply with choice. I think a lot of women actually get to a certain level and think, actually, maybe I'd rather be in control of my own time.
So how did that happen, that women progressed in television so quickly?
I think it might have something to do with the fact that a lot of the people watching television are women. There is an appetite for the sort of shows that women quite like making. Drama, sort of stuff I do, lifestyle stuff, is very female-driven and largely made by women. So there was a sense that they were needed.
Daisy says that women make up a large chunk of the viewing audience, and you're pitching ideas which are going to appeal to that audience. They're going to be easily understood, by and large, by our commissioning team. If you're from a minority group and you have a very particular experience which you're trying to put forward, and the person who's considering the idea has no idea where that comes from, it's going to be much harder.
Do you see parallels, perhaps they're depressing parallels, between the experience of women and the experience of people from ethnic minorities?
Well, I think one of the things that happened for women, certainly in the BBC, was the Women's Development Initiative, which gave a whole group of women, Jaina was part, I think Lorraine was part, which gave them access to people at the highest level of the BBC. It gave them access to strategy briefings, gave them access to coaching, to mentoring, to job shadowing, and networking. That's what needs to happen on the minority front now. Learn the lessons of what worked well for women and apply them to minorities.
Daisy, how did you get on?
I was just, you know, reasonably ambitious, got on the training scheme. I'm probably the one that stayed the course, actually. A lot of the men on that scheme are now running their own companies or running channels, and I'm the only woman now running a company. But I think women like me probably don't see any barriers to them in television. I think more of the issue is people in minorities who can't see how or why they would go into television.
But it's a long-term process, isn't it? Because even though there's diversity on screen now, there's no diversity behind the screen. And if you want to start somewhere, you have to start at the bottom. So it's going to be 10 or 15 years, isn't it?
Well, that's what they said 10 or 15 years ago, and we're still waiting. And the problem is, I mean, the BBC are getting 15% of their people coming in are ethnic minority, but they never get to the top. I know lots of people who've given up on television altogether. You know, there's only so long people will wait before they just decide that this is an industry they're going to get forward in and move on.
Daisy Goodwin and Pat Young there. Do you think, Tim, that despite all the talking, that there hasn't been enough action? It's quite clear that that's the case, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, Jaina was on that panel, for example, on the diversity panel today, and she's sort of on a hiding to nothing, and you end up sort of saying, well, we have this scheme, that scheme, and it's worth saying, because it's well-intentioned, but clearly the results aren't right, and I thought Jaina actually probably should have said, because she was particularly pressed on whether she thought it was a, I can't remember the phrase, but in a sense a cause of regret, a crisis or whatever, that there isn't a black TV controller, and she wouldn't say it was, and I sort of think you should say it, probably should say that. I think we should
all
agree.
She started reeling off some names, and then she got to about two or three, and then you realise you couldn't get any further.
Yeah,
you know, and if you can name every single black senior TV executive,
exactly,
there's something wrong.
The interesting thing I thought, pithy point Safraz, one of the guys on the panel, made was that, you know, it looks like it's far more likely that there'll be a black man running the White House than running White City BBC. But of course, actually, the point is, it actually, or even sort of becoming deputy head of specialist factual, frankly, at Virgin. I mean, it's that bad, isn't it? That's the point.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting. And the point he made, which I would hold my hand up to, is that in the end, we, I think not willfully, subconsciously, are sort of looking for clones of ourselves and who we surround ourselves. And I'd happily say, I'm sure if I look back at the people I brought on, they're probably all chippy, comprehensive people. If we agree it's a problem and if we're going to do something about it, we need to sort of break that circle. And incentivising people, I can confirm, works.
I think that's absolutely right.
Why do you think, Emily, that the cause of women in television has been so successfully promoted, but not that of a...
I think it has. I'm sorry, I want to see the statistics.
That's not true, though.
I think, okay.
Depends what... Look back 30 years.
Okay, look back 30 years. That really isn't... That's a low bar, Tim. If you saw at entry level in television and the media in general that actually representation is probably skewed slightly in favour of females, I think when you get through to the layers of senior management, it becomes something like... I don't know, sort of 85% male to 15%. And you think, well, how did we go from sort of 51-49 in favour of women at one end? And people will say, well, it's, you know, they go and have children and figures? They don't come back. Well, you know,
literally plucking them out of thin air here in Edinburgh.
Not literally plucking out of thin air. I think that there are, of the FTSE 100 companies, there's something like sort of 8 female executive directors amongst 100 companies. And that's pretty average.
Yeah, but that's average. A wider kind of thing.
No, it's just that I'm sorry. But you know, you are looking at, as I say, of all the sort of the national broadcasters, you have got one woman who's actually in charge, and she's not even allowed to be in charge of that for the moment. And you could say, well, even if you're including, you know, Sky, etc., in that, that's kind of a, that's not a great strike rate. If you look at the executive boards and management of most companies, the women are 20 to 30% at best represented. The BBC is better than most places.
I'm sure, but dodgy figures aside, you're clearly right.
But back with my properly sourced figures and embarrass you all.
I suppose one point you make, the journey that sort of gender equality one seems to be a little bit more convincing.
Okay, well, before we leave that, I suppose you mentioned FTSE 100, Emily. I suppose we should have a minute silence for ITV dropping out of the FTSE 100 this week. Maybe not a minute.
<That's right.
laughs> Maybe not a minute.
Well, let's have 5 seconds silence. It's John Cage.
Before we go, we should...
Tim can buy it.
We should... Endemore could probably buy ITV now.
I've been told just to say no comment all the time. Is that right?
Yes, him personally.
You can afford it.
We can all chip in, I'm sure.
Festival highlights and lowlights. Lowlights are much more fun. Tim,
I can't possibly give you any lowlights as executive chair of it. It's all been wonderful and cuddly and marvellous.
8 out of 10 cats?
Yeah, my performance in 8 out of 10 cats, I think. It was a personal low.
How about you, Emily?
Highlights, actually, it was being on stage this morning with Clay Shirky, who did a Future View, after which, and Clay is... He is the New York University professor for the Interactive Telecoms Programme, but he's also kind of, he's been sort of top media new thinker for years and years. He's a very, very clever man.
He's an internet guru.
And the interesting thing is he's also the leading Tom Hanks lookalike for the new media industry. But afterwards, I was inundated.
I once got a letter to Tom Hanks sent to me.
Did you?
Yes.
Tom Hanks. Well, Clay, afterwards, I was inundated by people saying he was absolutely fantastic. I went to the Future View expecting to be bored. I said, what an inspiration. And women wanting to marry him. Because they
come to Edinburgh, find a wife.
Indeed, he's got one already.
Find another one.
Some children on Fire Island.
But it's Edinburgh, none that matters.
And my low light. Availability of taxis outside the track air last night at whatever it was.
What, 4 in the morning? No.
it was actually a moderately early hour, but still, no bloody taxis.
All right then, listen, that's it for now. My thanks to guests Tim Hinks and Emily Bell. We're back in the comfort and warmth of the studio next week. Media Talk in Edinburgh has been produced by Scott Corley. I'm Matt Wells. Bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.